Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little reminder, we're Zooming this show on Sunday afternoon, and not only do we Zoom on Sunday, but we begin every show as we had since March with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I knew after I heard him testify that I wanted to always remember what he said. And then when they fired him and marched him out of the White House, I knew that I needed to have all of us remember collectively what he said. So we begin every show as we have since March with the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. He has recently appeared in a new advertisement by Vote Vets, and he and his wife talk about that experience. So if you don't get a chance to see it, go check my Facebook page because I posted it there. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, impeachment hearing 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
It's going to be an interesting Rethink the Week. We have a fabulous group of voices coming in from all over the country with lots of different experiences under their belt. So let me start first with Rick Newman. I have known Rick Newman forever. Rick was a former legislator. When I first met him, we were both legislators. He went on to become a lobbyist. He is both a Canadian citizen as well as an American citizen. And what was your relationship with the city of Portsmouth? Were you a mayor, Rick? What was your connection to Portsmouth?
I was a city councilman in Portsmouth back in the early 1980s.
Okay, so I just want to let you know he's gone through the whole sort of arc of the connection to politics. So let me welcome Rick to the program. Dean Spiliotis is with us. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar. He teaches at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com, and you can hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let me welcome Dean to the program. How are you, Dean?
Hi, Arnie. I'm doing well.
Great. Sean Sebastian has not been on with us for a long time. I was commenting on his hair and wondering whether he was getting a haircut in the next couple of years. But I met Sean because some folks in Iowa said he is the best, Arnie. He is one of the best activists, one of the best organizers, and they were right. So I grabbed him from Iowa, but now he's residing in New York. He is a senior strategist for People's Action. And when it comes to sort of progressive politics and knowing about organizing and sort of feeling the pulse of what's happening out there, you turn to Sean Sebastian. Thank you so much for joining me, Sean.
Thank you so much for having me. That was very kind.
It was a pleasure. And now someone who's become, can I even say this on the radio? A bosom buddy, but Val Endres has become a friend. She is a professor of political communications at Rhode Island College. I've gotten to meet her both in person. I've also had the opportunity to speak at Rhode Island College, which has always been an incredible pleasure. So I want to welcome from Rhode Island, Val Endres. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Arnie.
So I began the thought of what we should be talking about today with a couple of posts that I put on Facebook. And one of the first posts that I put on Facebook that I shared with you was about Governor Whitmer. And the reason why I wanted to talk about Governor Whitmer is that she brings up the most recent conversation Donald Trump had at a rally in Michigan. She brings up what's happening for politicians in America, especially those of the Democratic persuasion, because to some extent, Donald Trump has not only verbally accosted them. He's now actually put a target on their back. It also brings up the rise of the militia. It brings up the power of the NRA. It brings up a connection to white supremacy. So in a lot of ways, this one little Facebook post leads us into so many different directions when it comes to Donald Trump's America, because this is clearly what he has I'm not going to say that he created it, because I think it's always been there. What Donald Trump has done is celebrated it. And that's what makes it so frightening. So here's what I posted. If some harm comes to Governor Whitmer from a right-wing domestic terrorist group, can we accuse Trump of incitement to commit a crime? And then I linked that piece to a Reuters piece from October 17th. Trump blasts Michigan Governor Whitmer. Crowd chants, lock her up. I'm going to start with you, Val. Maybe that's unfortunate that you pulled the short straw, but you teach political communication. So in a lot of ways, this is about how Trump communicates and who he's communicating to. So as you look at this, he's not tapping it down. He's in fact encouraging it, and not only encouraging it from the White House, but encouraging it in the home of Governor Whitmer in Michigan. I mean, it's to me so toxic and so unbearable. And I'm just trying to figure out, how do you put a sock in it? How do you stop him, since he is the most powerful man in the United States?
I don't think there's any way that we can stop it. But in many ways, Donald Trump doesn't understand the power of presidential rhetoric. And in other ways, he understands it all too well. And by that, what I mean is every word counts. And I had an interesting discussion with my class this week, because they believe, because of his speaking style, that he sometimes says things that he doesn't mean. And I took issue with that perspective. And I said, I think Donald Trump knows exactly what he means and what he does. And we're beyond the point of being able to control him. He is a president who incites violence, and on our own soil. And I don't think there's any stopping him. I mean, I think the great concern is, over the next few weeks, what will he do to incite violence?
Well, I'm gonna ask you, I'm gonna go to the other professor in the group. So Dean, as I'm listening to Val and Val's students saying that he really doesn't mean what he says, he doesn't understand what he says, I hear that from his press secretary. I hear that from, you know, Kellyanne Conway. I hear that, and yet they're shut down for that all the time. But isn't it interesting that their excuses for him is what Val Endres' students heard, that somehow they bought that hook, line, and sinker. And that makes me sort of question, how do we say what they're saying is a lie too? I mean, we know Donald Trump lies, but their cover up for him, their spin on him, that's a freaking lie as well, because he knows exactly what he's saying. But yet for whatever reason, there are so many people that somehow excuse that behavior as if it's excusable, Dean.
Yeah, well, this is nothing new. We've been hearing this for 4 years, that it first in the context of him saying, you know, making outrageous statements on Twitter, and then his staff saying, well, you know, that's, or members of Congress, even Republicans saying, well, that's just, you know, the president being the president, that's just how he is. And I think with regard to the Michigan situation, I think his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, was on TV earlier today saying, oh, he was just joking around. He didn't really mean, he was just having fun, I think is what she said. You know, at this point, it almost doesn't really matter. You know, they've apologized for him for all 4 years. It's the same basic kind of behavior. Whether he secretly knows that it's dangerous behavior and he does it anyway, or whether it's just, you know, something he does and doesn't really think about the consequences, you know, it almost doesn't matter. At this point, the only way we're going to have a change is if he's defeated on November 3rd. He's done nothing to suggest that he hears any of these critiques, or if he does, that he cares for them. He's not someone who, you know, reflects on feedback and changes course. He just kind of does his thing. He seems to like doing it at a kind of an instinctive level. He gets some sort of pleasure out of it, obviously. Right. But I think he also thinks it's useful from an instrumental perspective. He knows that a lot of his base seems to enjoy it. So that's why he throws it out there at these rallies.
See, I don't think
chanting, They were chanting "Lock her up" about the Michigan governor this weekend.
Oh, I know, I know. So, Sean, what I'm thinking about is, I don't think this ends with the election. I think his language is that he's now disgusted with the U.S. military because he thought they were his military, the way Bill Barr was his AG. So he's looking at this militia group, and he's looking at QAnon, and he's looking at the Boogaloo Boys, and he's actually saying these things, not even for his base, but for them. And I think he thinks they're his army. And what he is doing is sort of ensuring, you think I walk away and that it's going to be quiet, even if Joe Biden gets 5 points or 10 points or 15 points, I may not have the U.S. military with me, but I've got another group of people that are ready for insurrection, that are armed to the teeth, that have AK-47s and AR-15s. And I've been buying more guns in the last month than they probably bought in the last year. And I think this is done intentionally. And I think this isn't done to be funny. And I think this is about his plan for what happens after his loss. And the loss isn't going to be at the voting booth. He thinks that he's going to have his own private military because he's basically stoking them and preparing them for this.
You know, Arnie, you bring up so many good points. I think I just want to address a couple of them.
Oh, no, please.
One is that the really dangerous conflation of the right of these like right-wing white supremacist militias, the armed right-wing vigilante wing of the right wing, and the Republican Party, which are increasingly working together, and there's no distinction between them, right? So we've seen this for all 4 years. Remember, when Charlottesville happened, Trump was asked very directly whether he would condemn white supremacy, and he called them very fine people, right? At the debate, Trump was asked to condemn white supremacy, and he didn't, and he told the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by, exactly. Right? And then just, right in the few days after, a right-wing militia who are Trump supporters, who were inspired by Trump attacking Governor Whitmer, they were plotting to kidnap her. And just a few days later, Trump is leading chants against her. And her social media manager came on Twitter today and said, "Let me tell you, I manage the governor's social media account. And every time one of these things happen, there's an uptick in violent threats against the governor." And he knows this. He knows it. There's no way for him not to know it. And I think, obviously, we know this is who Donald Trump is. We know that this is a base that he does not want to alienate, and he supports them. What's really troubling to me is we have two parties in this country, Democrats and Republicans. And Republicans, that's one thing for Trump. We know that this comes from Trump, but where are the other Republicans? Where are the other Republicans who are repudiating Trump for giving support to white supremacists? Where are all the other Republicans when asked at the town hall about the QAnon conspiracy and whether or not a pedophilic cabal is controlling government? Donald Trump said, "I don't know. I don't know that." Like, where is the rest of the Republican Party? So if we're seeing the cozying up of Trump and these white supremacists, well, Trump is the leader of the party, and how many Republicans are going up against Trump? So to me, what's really troubling is the mainstreaming of these white supremacist vigilantes into one of our two parties, right? Like, we have, it's really, really scary.
Let me go to Rick. So Rick, before I grab Ken, as I'm hearing this, and it really is a real fabulous article that was just posted today at The Guardian. I don't know if you saw it, but it was actually saying, Sean, exactly what you were just saying. Okay, there's no question. And they were saying, how do we stop this? Is sort of the last question in this Q&A. And the last question is, what can Democrats do? And he said, they can't. Republicans have to do it. He said, because it's now completely owned by the Republican Party. This is now a brand. They now have embraced, even if they claim, "Oh, I'm not a white supremacist. Oh, I'm not." Yes, you are. Because if there's any way of sort of controlling this, it's got to be it's got to be a Republican thing to do, which right now they're incapable of doing. But Rick, it's more than that. Look at what the NRA has done. You and I both know the NRA from the 1980s. This is not your father's NRA. This is a very, very different NRA. This is an NRA that has now gone to an extreme that really is, in some ways, part of the support system for the white supremacists and the Boogaloo Boys. I mean, and that's what's scary too, because every politician is so intimidated, Rick, by the NRA. And look at our state. Our state is a state that basically has no gun laws. You can bring a gun in anywhere. You can bring a gun into the state house. You don't need to have it registered. You don't have to know how to use it. You know, you're trained more in how to use toilet paper as a child than you are in how to use a gun, Rick. And now when you combine the weaponization that has been encouraged by the NRA, the complete subservience of the Republican Party to Donald Trump, who's now aiding and abetting this, there is something wrong here. And there's a party that I'm not sure is political anymore, but they feel more like traitors to me than they feel like party politics to me, Rick.
I agree, and I think many of them are, but I think there's a bigger group of people that are complicit and responsible, and that is the collective media. I mean, you know, they just let him get away with this, okay? So he says, I'll give you my healthcare plan in 2 weeks. And then he says, lock her up about Governor Whitmer, and the story and everybody talks about is what he said about Governor Whitmer, but no, everybody forgets to say, where's your healthcare plan? Every media person, every press person that comes into contact with him every single time should hold his feet to the fire. Where is that plan? Where is the infrastructure bill? It's been 4 years. Don't tell me you can't get it through Congress. You had 2 years when the Republicans controlled both bodies. You know, Savannah Guthrie said to him, Val talked about, you know, Trump doesn't seem to grasp, or maybe he does, that, you know, when you're a president, you say something, your words matter. And, you know, Savannah Guthrie said to him, you know, you're not someone's crazy uncle. When she said that, I thought about Mary Trump, because she's sitting there going, oh, yes, he is. You know, I mean, he's now America's crazy uncle. Except that when that crazy uncle says something stupid like that, it causes people to act, and it could literally.
But it's not stupid, Rick. Take that word back. He's not saying a stupid word. This is you're buying it.
No, exactly.
It's not targeted.
But he does it for diversion, and he does it. He has played the media completely like a fiddle for 4 years, and they need to be held accountable too.
Ken.
I agree completely with Rick on the media has to be held accountable to hold Donald and the Republicans accountable. But I wanted to get back to Sean's point about the militias and their ties to the Republican Party. Just bring in one other part of it, and that is that the militias and vigilantes out on the streets carrying guns up into Michigan State House are also intertwined, not just with the Republican Party, but with portions of the U.S. military. Yeah. And the Trump administration sends Border Patrol and ICE agents with their identifying information ripped off their clothes to Portland to beat up and arrest and harass people. And the people can't tell the difference between whether these are federal agents, which they are, or vigilantes like Trump.
They are too,
about.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And the other example I want to give is the ICE Citizens Academies, which ICE proposed doing, inviting people who are not members of the federal troops, people who are vigilantes, to come and work with and be educated by ICE in the up-to-date weaponry and how to use it to go out and gather up immigrants and detain them and deport them. There's this merging between some elements of our military as well as vigilantes, that's very, very scary.
And I want to go back to the comment about the fact that this is now just Trump. There's no excuse for Trump. Trump knows exactly what the power of his words are. He knows what he was doing in Michigan. He knows he's putting a target on her back. He knows he's sending a message to Boogaloo on QAnon. But I want to bring it back, Val, to the Republican Party directly. So we did an amazing, amazing interview with this woman from UNH, Jennifer Spindell. And she looks at the U.S. military, and she made a connection between the U.S. military and white supremacists. It was a fabulous article, everyone. You've got to read it. But again, it was another one of my comments when I sent you out topics. And it says, in 2019, the House approved a requirement to screen potential military enlistees for signs of white nationalism and white supremacy as part of the Pentagon's annual budget allocation. But the Senate, controlled by Mitch McConnell, controlled by the Republicans, removed the provision for sending the bill to Donald Trump. This is 2019. And what we know, so this was a question that was going to be asked of these people that one-on-one list. What's your relationship to white supremacists? What's your relationship to white nationalism? Let's vet these people because we don't want to teach them how to weaponize. We don't want them in our ranks. They pulled that provision out in 2019. And I asked her, whose fingerprints were on it, Val? She couldn't tell me. Nobody knows. But isn't it interesting? It happens on Mitch McConnell's watch in a Republican-controlled U.S. Senate, which I think is just so important. And then you look at the people that were arrested in Michigan. What? How many of them had a relationship to the U.S. military? At least 3 out of the 13. All right? So this, again, is the Republicans have to own this. If there is this rise in this militia and there is this instability, they have fed it, Val. And it wasn't just out of Trump's mouth. It's what they did in that military budget bill. They pulled out even asking the question.
You can say that the Republicans have to own it, but who is forcing them to own it? And that's why I want to go back and reemphasize what Rick had to say here about the responsibilities of the media. You know, much has been said about the media being the fourth estate, or even the Washington Post saying that democracy dies in the dark. But when the rubber hits the road, the media is virtually absent. And I think they have a responsibility as well to maintain the principles of democracy. And I think what's going on there, Arnie, is something that Sheldon Whitehouse pointed out in the Supreme Court hearings, and that is the role of corporate interests and the role of dark money. And so I think if you follow the money, and even if it's something like white supremacists being allowed to enlist in the military, I do believe that there's corporate interests behind it, and there's a lot of money behind all of this. Okay. And I think it, you know, what Sheldon Whitehouse was attempting to do is to start unpacking that very complex web. But I do want to hold members of the media's feet to the fire on this.
Okay, so Dean, let me just take Val, and then we're gonna have to end this for a segment. So Dean, how often does Donald Trump come on MSNBC? How often does he come on NBC, ABC, CBS? He has a home, and the home is his echo chamber. His home is either Fox or he's making love to Rush. I mean, that's basically it. You know, it's Sean Hannity, it's Fox, it's whatever. So who do you hold accountable? I mean, very few Republicans now are even available to anything but, you know, their friendly media. Donald Trump now, he used CNN, he used MSNBC, he used NBC to get elected. But no sooner does he get elected than he flips the bird at them. And then he goes back to the womb, and the womb is Fox. So I'm just trying to figure out, how do you hold this weasel accountable when he makes sure he's never in a situation where you can basically say what happened during that town hall? That town hall was so shocking because it was so unique, Dean. It doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, and I think it was probably motivated by either by Trump himself or a senior member of his campaign explaining to him that he needed to attempt to reach, make at least one more try at reaching a broader audience. But, you know, that's just not his comfort zone. As you mentioned, back in 2016, he was regularly on MSNBC and the networks, but we talked about this before, he would call in on the phone when he felt like it. But no, you don't really see, occasionally you'll see, he'll do a sit down interview with a network correspondent, but it's just kind of the nature of our information ecosystem now. It's polarized. Social media and just the nature of technology has allowed people to stay in their comfort zone and to kind of reinforce their core messaging with their supporters. The whole idea of winning people over or persuading people the way, you know, most presidential campaigns were about persuading and winning over the folks in the center. That seems almost quaint, kind of a bygone era. Maybe we'll come back around to that. But that's not how the information ecosystem functions anymore. I mean, it sounds like, you know, Trump's on Fox News pretty much every day, sometimes
for an hour. Let's make it two, yeah. You know? I mean, that's
the shows are ending and he's still talking.
It's exactly right. All right, we need to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our rethink with our great panel of guests. We'll be right back.
Were you ever taught when you were young? If you mess with things selfishly, they're bound to come undone. I'm not the only one that's been affected and resented every story you've spun, and I'm a lucky one. Cause there are people worse off that have suffered enough. Haven't they suffered enough? But you can't get enough of shutting down systems for personal gain, fighting fires with liars and praying for rain. Do you get off on pain? We're not pawns in your game. Commander-in-chief, honestly, if I did the things you do, I couldn't sleep. Seriously, do you even know the truth? We're in a state of crisis. People are dying while you line your pockets deep. Commander-in-chief, how does it feel to still be able to breathe? We were taught when we were young, if we fight for what's right, there won't be justice for just some. Won't give up, stand our ground. We'll be in the streets while you're bunkering down. Loud and proud, best believe, we'll still take a knee while you're commander-in-chief. Honestly, if I did the things you do, I couldn't sleep. Seriously, do you even know the truth? We're in a state of crisis, people are dying while you line your pockets deep. Commander-in-chief, how does it feel to still be able to breathe? Be able to breathe.
Welcome back to Part 2 of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We have Sean Sebastian, who is a senior strategist with People's Action. I met him originally when he was in Iowa. Somehow now he's hanging out in New York. Welcome back to the program, Sean. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we have Rick Newman. Rick Newman is currently a lobbyist in the state of New Hampshire. He has been very involved in municipal government. We met in the legislature back in the 1980s. And he, like Arnie, spent way too much time sort of focusing on politics, in part because New Hampshire is the home of the First in Nation presidential primary. So between local politics and national politics, Rick, it's all we know. Am I right?
That's correct.
Absolutely. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome back, Dean.
Always good to be with you, Arnie.
Thanks. And Val Endres is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. So we haven't talked about the two big things that should be driving people to vote, and they're showing up in droves, everyone. It's just incredible. I'm watching Texas, where it's early voting. They even got an extra week of early voting, but they're starting out and they're waiting online for 9 hours in Texas. I'm like, holy mackerel. But the two big drivers, I think, of this, and I'm going to turn to you first, Sean, and that is that it's the economy, stupid. And there were a couple of stories that I saw, and I posted them also on our possible topics. Public Citizen did something very charming. They went back to like 2009, and they looked at the minimum wage. And the minimum wage was $7.25 in 2009, 2010, and 2011. The minimum wage has not changed. And then they looked at the Fortune 400 or whatever, the Forbes 400. I looked at the wealthiest people in America, and they went back to 2009, and they went to today. And their increase in wealth was like off the charts. It was off the charts. They had like almost tripled their wealth. Was it billions or trillions? I think it was trillions. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking there was a lot of anger and frustration before the economic meltdown. And then there was the economic meltdown and people saw their mortgages disappear, their jobs disappear. And they thought that Barack Obama of all presidents would help them out. And then Barack didn't show up. He showed up for the most part for the wealthy. He returned Wall Street to being whole, if not even bigger than whole. And then they started to slowly begin to make it, but making it doesn't mean anything when you're in a hole, okay? You haven't even gotten to the surface yet. And then of course, the pandemic hits. And we see a situation now that is virtually unconscionable for so many people. And I am trying to figure out how Joe Biden fills the hole, but why would Republicans want this hole to continue to grow? Because they have to go back to states like Kentucky, like Tennessee, like Louisiana, like Alabama. And those are the states that are hurt the most. And they have to be somewhat responsible for aiding and abetting this absolute assault on their virtual, almost 60 or 70% of their population, unlike what you see in the Northeast and in some other places. How are they thinking? How could they only be thinking of Trump when they have to survive after him? And I am trying to figure out what survival looks like for them.
So, I mean, I think we've been through this movie before, right? We know what it looks like when a disastrous president drives the economy into a hole, and how when, you know, the Democrats come into power, all of a sudden the Republicans decide they care about the deficit, right? After exploding the deficit with massive tax cuts,
right,
we can expect when, if and when Joe Biden comes into power, all of a sudden they're going to care about the deficit. And that's, we've been through this before. And like you said, in 2008, there was a $14 trillion hole in the economy. And what we needed was a massive, massive stimulus program to put people back to work. When you're in a depression, you need a new deal, right? Like, we know this from our history.
Right.
And Republicans limited the scope of that. And I agree with you, like, Barack Obama was not aggressive enough and thought there would be another package coming down the pike, and he was sorely, sorely mistaken. And we can't make that same mistake this time. And we can't let Republicans pretend all of a sudden the deficit matters, so we need to block stimulus. We need to make the stimulus smaller. No, we know the way that we got out of the last Great Depression was with a massive New Deal, with the CCC, with a massive government jobs program. And right now we are in the greatest recession since the Great Depression. And right, we have so much work to do to mitigate climate change. There's so much work that we can do for elder care, child care, infrastructure. There is so much that we can do, and we can't fall into the same trap of pretending like Republicans are serious when all of a sudden they get religion on the deficit.
Okay, so here's my fear, Sean, and I'm gonna go to Rick. So Rick, let's say we have control of the Senate, control of the House. We have Joe Biden in the presidency. Are we going to do what Republicans do, which is they freaking sprint. They don't just grab a mile, they grab 10 miles. They don't just grab a policy, they basically, you know, claim every policy. When they deregulated, they just didn't deregulate for the environment. They deregulated everywhere, as if somehow this was they grasp the idea of a mandate, and then they put it, then it becomes an Uber mandate. This is the time that Democrats need to learn from what Republicans do. And I don't mean about destructive things, but I mean they are instructive of taking the opportunity and the power they are handed and use it. And use it. My fear about Joe Biden is that Joe Biden has been around for so long, and he likes to do things about incremental change, and he wants to work with the other side. And it's kind of like this kumbaya thing. And I'm like, I'm putting my finger down my throat going, no kumbaya. You know, you've got to be aggressive, not only because we have the power and maybe only for a short time, but the electorate needs to see the consequences of the change yesterday. They need to feel it immediately, because otherwise their sense of disappointment will be overwhelming, and we can't afford that, Rick.
Yeah, and I honestly believe that, you know, 42 years of being involved in government, and I know exactly what you're talking about, and you would think because of Biden's history that his instinct would be to first day on the job, let's have a meeting with the Republicans on the, let's get together, let's figure out a compromise, this, that, or the other thing. I don't believe they're going to do that. I really and truly don't. Assuming Biden wins, and I'm convinced the Democrats will get control of the Senate, I think you are going to see a sprint. And I think you're going
to
see,
you have to
say, hey guys, all bets are off. You get us in 2 years, we'll deal with you at the midterms. Go ahead, take your case to the people and tell them that we did bad things. But I believe you're going to see Democrats say, I hate to use this term because it's become so overused, but I really do believe that the last 4 years has been a collective teachable moment to Democratic politicians in Washington, where they sit back and try to work. Obama made a huge mistake on Obamacare by trying to make it bipartisan, and in the end didn't get a single Republican vote. And we should have learned from that. But I believe now we have learned. I believe they have learned. And I believe that you're going to see infrastructure that Sean talked about. You could put millions of people to work. And look at the interest rates. My God, when Ronald Reagan was running these huge national annual deficits, interest rates were 10, 12, 14%.
Yeah.
You can borrow money for nothing now.
Right.
Now's the time to borrow a bunch of money and build bridges and sewer systems and water systems and hospitals and all of those things. I mean, it makes perfect sense. You put people to work and you generate tax income.
Well, not only that. So, Rick, this is so perfect because I'm looking at New York Magazine. And New York Magazine has a section called Intelligentsia. Conservative think tank finds Biden tax hike only hurts the rich, right? So when you read it, what they say is that it will not only, it might somehow hurt the economy, but actually what they keep saying is, well, maybe actually the economy will do much better. Because by investing all these social programs and all these infrastructure programs and all these healthcare programs and all this investment, you actually might not only, you might actually improve the economy. And the only people that might be hurt will be the rich. So Val, let me just ask you a question. Will the rich be hurt so they won't be rich after the tax hikes? Or the rich still be rich? I just want to know. I want to know, which house will they give up? Which yacht will they give up? I want to know what island they're going to have to sell. Here's the kicker.
Give up a maid.
Exactly. Here's the kicker. The rich will not be hurt. They are so uber rich that they are richer than they were in the 1980s. They're richer than they were in the 1990s. They're richer than they were in the 2000s. They're richer than they were in the 2010s. So if they get a tax hike, Val, they'll still be freaking rich. And you know what? And the economy will begin to stabilize. So not only will they be rich, but people will be able to survive and grow and dream. How can you not raise taxes on the rich? It doesn't hurt them. And the country as a whole changes dramatically.
Hey, Arnie, can I throw a question out for Val and Rick?
Yeah.
You know, all of this seems to me predicated on if the Democrats win the Senate, eliminating the filibuster.
Right.
Do any of my colleagues here think that they will, in fact, eliminate the filibuster in the Senate?
All right, Val first.
I'm gonna back up for just a second before I answer that and say that I'm not sure that I share Rick's optimism about the Democratic Party. And I'm looking at the fact that Joe Biden, despite all the great progressive ideas during the primary, it was Joe Biden who won. And I still believe that there's a lot of hand-wringing with the Democratic Party about having a fair fight. And whether they will get the nerve to punch back, even if it is a righteous cause, I don't know if they're capable of doing that. There's a number of things that they have to do. They have to end the filibuster. They probably have to pack the court. They have to think about expanding the Supreme Court for a balance. And they have to have a tax on the rich. And they have to have redistribution of wealth. But again, I'm going back to those tentacles of money and corporate money and the power of the corporations. And I'm not so sure it's going to happen. We've all read the analyses of Jeff Bezos and how much money he had. And if he redistributed some of his wealth, he would still be incredibly rich. But on the other hand, it's going to take very strong, very aggressive action. And the Democrats have to be ready for those kinds of enemies.
So answer to these questions. Do you think that they will get rid of the filibuster?
I do think they will get rid of the filibuster. And I think one of the things that we maybe have a little different this time than we've had in the past is we're going to have I believe we're talking about Biden winning. So Biden wins. We've got a president who's 77 going on 78 years old. He doesn't have time to sit back and try to build bonds with his old colleagues in the Senate. His legacy building begins almost on day one. I think that's first thing. I think the second thing is, I really believe that people like Joe Biden are really angry at what the Republicans did the last 4 years and the way they've misused the office of being in the Senate. So I do think, Val, that they will be willing to punch back. I think we're going to see it for the first time. I agree with you that for our history, we haven't done it. But I think we're going to see a difference. And the last thing is this. There's going to be a bunch of senators elected that got elected to do just what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's
true. They have to do something.
Let me go back to Dean for a second. To Dean, and then I'm going to go to Sean. So I kind of want to believe you, Rick. I'm a little bit like Val. I'm not quite sure I believe. And the reason is this, Dean. When Dianne Feinstein praised Lindsey Graham for this incredible hearing on Amy Coney Barrett, and so I had to like swallow that. And then when she hugged him, I went screaming into the shower. Okay, just could not believe it for a couple of reasons. One, in the middle of COVID, you're not supposed to touch, okay? So you think that would have at least been her excuse, but she was effusive. She was ecstatic. She was, and I'm looking at her, and while I know she's older than Joe Biden, but they're kind of from the same, you know, ilk. They're from that same period. And that scared me in some ways, Dean, more than you could possibly imagine. Like, look at these Democrats. They're so desperate for this concept of bipartisanship that they don't even realize they're being stabbed in the back and they're being smiled at. And you hug the guy that's holding the knife.
And Arnie, I just want to interject a second and remember the speech that Biden gave 2 weeks ago where he was talking about the importance of national unity and bringing the two parties together. And that was seen by the Biden campaign as his premier speech of this campaign.
Okay, so Dean, answer the question, then yeah. I got a comment on that.
Sure, yeah, you know, I saw the Dianne Feinstein comments and her hugging, and I thought in general, kind of her demeanor was sort of an anachronistic throwback to the old days when the Senate was very clubby. And it was the cooling saucer of democracy. And everybody was just going to kind of settle down. And the Senate would come up with a compromise that was palatable to everyone. But then you listen to, you know, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and some of these other senators, Senator Hawley. You listen to these guys and those days are long gone. And so, you know, Joe Biden, you know, he talks like he's going to bring back the era of good feelings, but he is going to be under tremendous pressure from not only the left wing of his party, but just sort of a good chunk of the party to not let himself get bogged down. And my guess is that the Senate, you know, let's say Trump were to lose and it were a significant blue wave, a lot of the Republicans in Congress, particularly in the Senate, are going to rediscover their fiscal conservatism. They're going to rediscover their kind of free trade and interventionist foreign policy. A lot of the Trump stuff potentially could just kind of go out the window. And then Biden is facing a very different policymaking environment.
Okay, so Sean, let me just say something. So I want to go back to what Val said, that, you know, Joe Biden gave the speech 2 weeks ago about the bipartisanship and all that stuff. He doesn't have to be bipartisan. He has to bring people together. I don't want to bring Republicans. I want to bring people together. A lot of people don't even admit to being either party. The largest party in New Hampshire are undeclareds. That's 40% of the population. They don't even like to label themselves Republican. They don't even like to label themselves Democrat. I don't want to hear the bipartisan word. The Republicans are not a party anymore. They have lost that right to call themselves a party. A party that doesn't support the concept of democracy. A party that doesn't want people to vote. A party that's embracing suppression. A party that basically is aiding and abetting a liar. A party that's encouraging people to support white supremacists and militia, which is what they are doing. I just told you about what they did in 2019 by not asking that question about people enlisting. That is not a party. So he's using old language at a time where I want him to bring people together, but it ain't about bringing parties together. I don't want to sleep with the Republicans. I don't want to talk to the Republicans. I don't want to even claim to know them, but I do want people to find consensus. And to use the language of partisanship is the wrong language, especially as we go into 2021.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And as for the question about the filibuster, I share Val's skepticism, but ultimately, you know, there are 210,000 people who are dead because of COVID, and COVID is spiking right now. There are 20 million people who are drawing down unemployment. If you want to do anything about that, if you want to do anything about the suffering that's happening in this country, you have to end the filibuster, because we know that Republicans will do everything they can to block it. So you may have some ideas about, you know, collegiality and the way the Senate used to be, but those ideas are not as important as hundreds of thousands of Americans dead, it's not as important as the greatest recession since the Great Depression. So if you care about people, and if you care about whether or not they can breathe, whether or not they can feed themselves, the filibuster is a small sacrifice to meet the needs that we have right now. And it's absolutely 100% necessary.
So Rick, I also posted something about our conversation today. So I am watching Ali Velshi, who I totally adore. I think he's the best guy on MSNBC. And he was talking, I guess this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month or something, I don't know. But anyway, they were talking about the fact that a lot of people aren't getting their cancer evaluations being done. They're not getting their mammograms. They're not being tested for prostate cancer because they're afraid of going to a hospital. They're afraid of going to a doctor, or they've lost their health insurance. Okay. So a lot of these things are being pushed to the back of the bus because of COVID. So the pandemic isn't just killing people from COVID. It may now be killing people because they're not getting their diagnosis in a timely fashion. They're not being treated for the other illnesses they have. So as I'm listening to this, Rick, a doctor came on and said, well, don't worry about if you lost your health insurance. We can give you a mammogram at either no cost or at a sliding cost. It's not a problem. Just come in and get your mammogram. Here is where the Democrats lose it again, and frankly, the media. And Rick, what I was screaming at Ali Velshi was, but if this ACA gets overturned by this Supreme Court, because they are literally going before the Supreme Court days after this election, and you might lose access to that, not only the ACA, but the concept of pre-existing conditions. What I wanted Ali Velshi, who obviously is not a girl and has never had a mammogram, what I wanted him to say is, you can get a cheap mammogram, but if they get rid of the ACA, you can't afford the answer. Because if you find out that you have breast cancer, you now have a pre-existing condition. So all the free mammograms in the world sound great, but guess what? You can't be treated, all right? Because you now are sick. And insurance companies don't want to cover people that are sick. That's called a pre-existing condition. This is an opportunity for us to talk not only about what the pandemic has done, but take the pandemic and the loss of health insurance, Rick, and then this idea of not being able to afford your mammogram. But even if you could afford a mammogram without the ACA, you can't afford the answer. You know, we have to connect all these dots, because they really, I think, not only urge people to vote, but they understand that this pandemic is more than just that illness. It's all the other illnesses.
Well, and you know, I've always been a big critic of the ACA anyway, but the couple of things it did do that were right was pre-existing condition protection and getting rid of the lifetime caps.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that is terrible about it is the fact that what they did is they wrote it in such a manner that all insurance companies have done is they've gone and they've sort of, what's that called, reverse engineered the health insurance policies. So the ACA requires certain things. Well, anything it doesn't require, insurance companies don't cover. So now you get an insurance policy. I'm a 61-year-old man, relatively healthy, married with a healthy wife, and I pay enormous premiums. And when you go to the doctor, you go to get something checked, you find out, oh, that comes under your deductible, which is incredibly high. Now, by the time you get your deductible taken care of, you're back to a new calendar year. So it starts all over again. So you never get any coverage for anything. Right. And you're tempted to say, why don't I just keep my money? I mean, we do need to look at all of that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it's six or five and pick them, whether they're going to overturn the ACA, that Supreme Court case. And that's where I go back to the media. Every single time Trump opens his mouth and says, I'm going to give you my health care plan in 2 weeks, every questioner from now until Election Day should say to him, where is that plan?
And Dean, what Rick is saying is not only where is that plan, he said that, and how many times did he say that, Rick?
And what and for at least a year and a half.
Oh, but he's been saying it like regularly. It's like sort of like a metronome, Dean. And what I would do if I was a reporter, I said, I believe you said that on March 3rd. I believe you said that on July 2nd. I believe you said that on June 4th. I believe it. And just hit him every single time and say, you know what? What month are you talking about? What year? What millennium? I just want to know. And in a way, it's a way to put him in a box because you just keep nodding like a China doll, like, sure, of course, in 2 weeks, of course, in 2 weeks. No, no, no. There is no 2 weeks. And I think that that is terribly important. But before we sort of like begin to end this conversation, I want to go to you, Dean, because you're a professor, as a professor. There was an article about, so this pandemic is terrible, but it's got to be really terrible for people that are just entering college. Because there was a couple of articles I read. One of them was that usually during an economic downturn, a lot of young people, you know what they do? They go to community college. They figured, I can't get a job, I'll get a skill. They're not going to community college. So they're not going there. They're not finding work. They're absolutely frightened by this pandemic. But then you've got people that are in college. And the question is, why should I incur debt when I'm getting a college experience that really is not only dissatisfying, but isn't necessarily producing the kind of maybe education I want, but then what's the job that I'm gonna go to? What's it gonna look like? So I'm incurring debt in a marketplace that looks horrific during a pandemic. And I'm not, I mean, it's like every bad thing that could happen to Generation Z is happening to Generation Z that made Generation X or whatever it is look like a walk in the park. And I think that is another thing that we have to address, because that's really about opportunity. It's also about how you have to invest in them because it's investing in hope. And I look at them being in despair because we have these conversations.
Yeah. I talk with students all the time, and I talk with other faculty members. And this is an experience I think is really going to sort of mark and define this particular generation that's coming of age. You know, you have high school seniors who their senior spring was completely ruined. And now they're either at home from remote for their new college, which was supposed to be their next big step, or they're on campus, but they're essentially doing online from their dorm rooms, and they only go out to get meals. You know, it's very difficult. And then juniors and seniors in college in particular are, you know, obviously have real concerns about the job market. You know, maybe freshmen and sophomore, by the time they're out, you know, in 4 years or so, things will start to turn around. But it's just very difficult emotionally. And I think it makes it increasingly hard to plan for the future. Now, you know, some schools are trying to help. SNHU has lowered its tuition significantly. Other schools have lowered their tuition, but that's not an across the board. But yeah, that's not an across the board. I saw one other interesting statistic that surprised me. Something like 52% of people age 30 and younger or something live at home, or 52% of 30-year-olds live at home. My generation, I'm a boomer, late boomer. You graduate from high school, you're like, love you folks, time to go off into the world. And that was pretty much it. But now so many kids are forced to, throughout their 20s into their 30s, basically live at home.
So Val, let me just say about living at home. I'm thinking about my grandparents. In my Italian family, it was not uncommon for many generations to live together. And the reason, and it was a good thing, because Zia would take care of the baby, and then the baby would, like, so it was only, this has become like this interesting concept that you're supposed to leave. This is about liberation and leaving. And so in a way, I think the idea of living at home is not necessarily per se a bad thing. It may in fact be something positive. What it is a bad thing for, Val, is that those young people used to buy houses. Those young people used to buy cars.
Not a choice, right. All right.
So who's really lamenting this, I think, are the economy that sort of focused on these young people buying crap and, you know, and having their own individual identities. And if you live at home, you can borrow the car and you don't need to rent. You know, it's so interesting how it changes the whole economic landscape of America.
Right. I do want to say, though, that the thing that I've noticed with college students is that they are sharing their parents' pessimism. And I think this dates before the pandemic, and we're talking the 2008 recession, in which families really didn't recover in the way that the administration, Obama, had said that they did. And this is what I'm noticing more and more, that their parents lost their homes. And they're not even living under the illusion, some of our students, that they will ever be able to buy a home. And so they are staying at home out of necessity to help with bringing an income in, because some of those parents never fully recovered and were fully employed from the 2008 recession. So, and this is impacting every single avenue of their life, including their ability to have children. And many of my parents or students are saying, I don't know that I'll ever be able to have children. I don't think that I can afford that. So we really are talking about a lost generation.
And Sean, I'm listening to Val, and I remember giving speeches back in the early 80s talking about the loss of the manufacturing jobs, and that it was so perfect that the women's movement happened right at the same time as we lost the manufacturing jobs, because we needed the mother in the workplace, okay? Because it took two incomes to basically replace the one. And then what happened was the incomes continued to decline, and we needed a ménage à trois because we needed someone else to bring in an income. And in a bizarre way, we're living the ménage à trois. Because those kids that are not able to leave are now basically there, not only because they can't find a place to live or rent, their income, their support is needed to maintain the rent, the mortgage, the taxes, the whatever, because their incomes have all flatlined. And I think that's the other thing that Joe Biden needs to figure out is we need to figure out how we can begin to tell people that, you know, there really is opportunity here. And the opportunity doesn't just mean a job. It means a job that you can actually survive on. Real quick, Sean.
I 100% agree with you, Arnie. That's it. I mean, the thing is, we have not fully recovered from the last recession, right? Like in rural areas, jobs never recovered. And now we're getting hit with another once in a century recession just 10 years later. There's not many more hits that we can take. Like we absolutely need policy at the scale of the crisis that we're facing, and an understanding that the scale of the crisis we're facing is bigger than anything we've ever had before. So we need a response that's bigger.
And on that note, I need to say goodbye to my fabulous panel of Rethink the Week, Rick Newman, Sean Sebastian, Dean Spiliotis, Val Endres, and my producer, Ken Barnes. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Freedom. Justice is the melody that let us shine.